Hello and welcome to your first, but certainly not our first recorded podcast for the Australian course charting the Australian Fantastic. I am Lucas Matala, one of your glorious hosts for these podcasts, and with me are Bettina Berger. She prefers to be called Tina, though. I'm sure she'll introduce herself now.
Yes, hello, I'm Tina, and I'm also here to talk about speculative fiction.
As am I, David, and let's see where we go with this.
And obviously today's topic is speculative fiction. We're just going to be talking about our experience of it, what it is, that kind of stuff. So what in the hell is speculative fiction?
Well, super weird question. As you would usually do in an academic discourse, you would try and find a definition so you can butcher it, come up with your own, and thus, you know, cash in on the failure of others and produce yourself as the brightest person in the room. I'm not going to do that.
Well, that was a devastating takedown of academia. Thank you.
Yeah.
We podcasters now, guys.
Yeah. And anyway, I think I really don't know what speculative fiction is, and I am not sure if this is actually the intention of this course, you know, to come up with a definition, really.
That's true.
That's a good point.
To be frank, I really don't know. I'm still exploring, and I'm still thinking about so many different things, what speculative fiction might be including. I think I have a...
You know what you said just now about exploring? Mm. I think that's a very good keyword, because it's kind of in a term as well, isn't it? Speculative fiction. Mm. We're just speculating about things. So to me, speculative fiction is about something that maybe isn't real, but not necessarily unreal either. It's something you can speculate about. Mm. It could become real. It might not be. It might be fantasy. Or it might be real, but you just don't know. So it's really a genre that gives you a lot of freedom to speculate and to explore.
Maybe something that is underneath the obvious. And I'm thinking particularly here of one of my favorite speculative fiction writers, and that would be Chinese-American writer Ted Chiang, for instance, right? And his short fiction. He has this unique ability, I would say, to integrate the fantastic, to integrate the speculative with the everyday, and it catches you by surprise. And it runs in your defenses, and you really have no idea it's coming, and that you're actually part of a much bigger speculation as to the nature of things, right, out of a sudden. And that is amazing, the way he does it. So what is speculative fiction? Well, his work certainly is.
I like to think of it as kind of imaginative work.
Yeah.
I'm certainly not saying realistic fiction or other types of fiction are not imaginative. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me or soundbite me on that. But I think there's something especially imaginative about speculative fiction, because it is so much geared towards, when we think of speculating, we think of the future. We think of possibilities, things that are different than the world that we live in. So I think that difference, that change, is part of speculative fiction to some extent.
I think it's also a term that has been used in many different meanings. We've been talking about how we can define it, but it could also just be used as a sort of umbrella term for the genres that we'll be talking about: fantasy, gothic, dystopia, and so on. And I've also heard it used to just define a certain kind of literary fantastic that isn't fantasy enough for scholars who don't like fantasy to scorn it. No, seriously.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, isn't that one of the reasons Margaret Atwood says she's not writing science fiction?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly the context I heard it in. A colleague said that they liked Margaret Atwood and speculative fiction, and then I pointed out that speculative fiction could also be The Lord of the Rings, and she was completely confused by that.
It's interesting, isn't it, how speculative fiction could really be anything and nothing at all. And I'm wondering sometimes if it is not a shortcut for something, I mean, in lieu of a better explanation, something that, like, magic realism is a label that you can put on stuff. We will talk about magic realism in a lot more depth, I hope. But I have a feeling that sometimes it is being used as an umbrella term, as a label for something that is supposed to embrace a whole nexus of things, but trying to pin it down and to really pinpoint is then very, very difficult. So maybe it's a cheap solution.
I think it definitely is kind of a cheap solution. Mm-hmm. To me, it comes back to, like, dime novels. A lot of what we would consider pulp or cheap fiction is speculative fiction. It's crime novels, it's gothic novels, it's science fiction, fantasy. And people usually don't ascribe very much literary value to them, even though everybody's reading it.
Yeah. And what is not speculative fiction? I mean, maybe that's the better not exactly the better question, but what if speculative fiction is supposed to be something, well, which type of fiction is not speculative in one way or the other, right?
I think there certainly is a section of fiction that I wouldn't class as speculative fiction.
Okay.
Like,
the realist novel.
Right, okay. Yeah, sure, I get that, yeah.
The historical novel.
Oh, wow.
But not all historical novels.
Yeah, not all.
Because there's historical fantasy.
Well, just like not all realistic novels. Magical realist novels. But I'm saying generally, we can talk about, especially if we're thinking of historical novels and realist novels, yes, there can be some crossover, but I think as a rule, the genre tends toward difference from speculation, right? Historical novels, because they tend not to be imagining possibilities so much in the past as giving us a story narrative that's using a particular feeling or mood or atmosphere, or giving us access to historical knowledge that might entertain us, bringing us just to a time when things were different.
I think there's an interesting tension between what you just said and the fact that lots of fantasy literature, which I think we would all class under speculative fiction,
yes,
actually takes inspiration from history.
Yeah.
And fantasy is quite involved with historical narratives. Yet
very true.
Something completely different than what you just said.
So. Yeah, that's a good point.
What about, I mean, Stuart Hall has this beautiful phrase, open-ended theorization. You know, open-ended theorization towards what exactly?
No, I mean, I completely side with that. Open-ended theorization is maybe what we need, especially when we look at genres, right?
Yeah.
Where are the borders between any genre, really?
It's really hard to say, isn't it? Speculative fiction, and I think if we talk about it, it really just depends on what you personally think, and you have to define that before you can have a meaningful conversation, because otherwise I'll be talking to my colleague and they'll be saying speculative fiction and mean just Margaret Atwood and that kind of literary stuff, and I'll be talking about The Lord of the Rings, and that there'll be a mismatch. And then you have other post-colonial writers of fantasy who prefer speculative fiction because fantasy and sci-fi have colonialist history, and that's a different way of using the term. And really, it just depends who you're talking to.
I mean, then we realize that none of this is actually very satisfactory in a way, right? Maybe we can identify a couple of texts that we would clearly, you know, call speculative fiction and see if we arrive at at something more substantial via this route.
That was exactly what I was going to suggest, because I was just thinking, man, listening to this podcast, you're just like, well, I guess I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, let's start with popular examples, and then we can kind of trace back and talk about some classic examples.
Yeah.
So, what are some popular examples of speculative fiction?
Yeah, I'll just throw science fiction in there, and I'll throw in Tat Chiang again, who wrote this beautiful short story or novella, if you will, The Story of Your Life, which is actually the literary inspiration for the major motion picture, The Arrival, in case you didn't know. So I would definitely say that this is a very contemporary example of a very contemporary speculation in fiction.
Mm.
Great movie.
If we take science fiction, we could also look at H.G. Wells,
sure.
War of the Worlds.
Yes.
So that would not be a contemporary example, but it still would be speculative.
Mm-hmm.
He's certainly speculating about his future. Mary Shelley, Frankenstein.
Yes.
That I would definitely count.
Canonical classic.
Yes. I see we're hanging around the classics after all. if we're still staying in sci-fi or that sci-fi slant, I guess it's time to talk about Atwood a little bit. We can talk about, obviously...
Hey, what's your classic? What's your famous one, though? Which one would you throw into the...
I guess I would throw in Isaac Asimov's Foundation or
right.
or the iRobot short story collection.
Yeah.
Although Asimov is a problematic author, I would say.
Yeah.
Isn't everybody, right? I think that his works have such a lasting influence both on science fiction, but also on actual science.
Yeah.
I think he's inspired a lot of ideas that people have invested in. Now, when it comes to contemporary examples, yes. Margaret Atwood, obvious choice. We can think of her very popular series, I don't remember its name. Starts with Oryx and Crake. That is obviously the most famous of the trio.
Is that its name?
The Mad Adam trilogy.
Yes.
Mm.
That is obviously the most popular example. No one would say that's not speculative, I don't think. And I think The Handmaid's Tale is another example.
That was the one that I wanted to address. Because when it comes to speculative fiction, and when we're saying it has to be sort of a digression from reality, then what do we do with a text like The Handmaid's Tale, which is frighteningly realistic?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something that's happening at the moment, but it's not something that I would completely reject from ever happening again.
Right? Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that Margaret Atwood at some point said about The Handmaid's Tale that the things that are being narrated in this text did happen to someone at some point in time. Mm. I didn't make it up. So
yes.
That's an interesting thing to comment on such a dystopic, no doubt.
Which I guess shifts us towards the dystopic end of things. So if we're talking about dystopia and utopia, I think obviously the classics that jump out to me are like 1984.
Sure.
But also The Handmaid's Tale. And we can definitely say there are things that are real in them,
mm-hmm.
or that appear to be real. And I think we could definitely say they're more on the realistic side of
mm-hmm.
this spectrum. But I would definitely say that it is still speculative. Ultimately,
mm-hmm.
even if some things are in common, there's so much difference. In The Handmaid's Tale, there's so much difference in culture, in actual culture to the culture that's being used as an example, right?
Mm-hmm. If we really think about it, every speculative fiction text has something real in it,
mm-hmm.
because writing isn't really possible otherwise. I mean, we can write about a planet that has pink grass and two suns. But there's still the concept of the sun is something real. Grass is something real. And we can't, I don't think we can conceive of something that has absolutely no tether to reality whatsoever.
Mm.
I think that would just be unreadable.
So are there any other like classic or contemporary utopias or dystopias we think would fit into this?
Give people the kind of fiction realm. I mean,
yeah.
Probably many of the texts that most of us would remember from our high school days, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Brave New World, for instance. I mean, you've mentioned 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Other texts might fall into that category. Walter Tavis' Mockingbird, for instance, which is a classic of sci-fi. But what about more ancient narratives, like, for instance, Thomas More's Utopia itself? and other political classics. And we will talk about these when we talk about utopia and dystopia at some point. Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, for instance, other political treatises and discourses, Machiavelli's work, all of which belong in the broader category of political philosophy and state theory, but they have those speculative elements in them that are being used towards different ends, really, but nevertheless, they do rely an awful lot on speculation, interestingly enough.
Absolutely. I mean, speculative fiction may be a contemporary term for a genre, but the genre itself is ancient. I mean,
yeah.
We have ancient texts, ancient mythologies that could still be described as speculative. Even if people believed in the events, they would still be something speculative
mm-hmm.
in the sense that they wouldn't happen to your everyday person. And so they'd still be in the realm of the miraculous.
I mean, certainly if we turn our attention to like the Christian Revelations narrative, I think that's a great example of speculative fiction. We have a person who's traveled to a different world. They are seeing beings that have not been seen before, flaming wheels that are able to communicate and such and so on. And I think that we can say that there is definitely a rich tradition through this vein, at least, to
mm-hmm.
speculative fiction.
Across cultures, by the way, just think about the Arabian Nights, so the Book of 1,000 Nights and One Night, for instance, which is a collection of folk tales that is replete with exactly that kind of imagery and speculative scenarios, by all means.
I think the term speculative fiction is so useful because it doesn't make a judgment as to the reality
mm-hmm.
of the text in question.
Mm-hmm.
If we think of fantasy literature, we quite often have this sort of binary in our minds between fantasy and reality, which I personally don't think is as strict as some people would like to see it.
No.
But speculative fiction doesn't even make that judgment. It's speculating. It doesn't say whether you're speculating about something that could potentially be the case on another planet, for example.
So there's the element of experimentation in there, by
all means? I think so, yeah.
Without, at the same time, being an anything goes mentality, because as you've just mentioned, right, there are a couple of limits that we would expect, and only so many things that we would accept at the end of the day. Yeah.
Yeah.
In that vein, I think we could shift our discussion to first fantasy and then maybe magical realism.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So let's first talk about fantasy for a little bit. So I think the one that I'm just going to throw out there, everybody would say this, is The Lord of the Rings, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is probably the most dominant narrative and trilogy, I guess. These works are trope makers. They've made so much, they've had such a wide influence too.
Yes.
On the genre.
Mm. Yes.
But what else is there? What else is classic fantasy or classical?
Classic. Well, there's the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which are quite well known and probably define some of the genre tropes for different subgenres.
Yeah.
Different-ish. The Portal Quest, because we have the Pevensey children going through the portal into Narnia. And that is quite a common trope.
And needless to say, Tolkien and Lewis were contemporaries, so they would exchange
friends.
Ideas very frequently. Friends, yeah, by all means.
And I've read some people have talked about how, in a way, Tolkien really ushered in the new tradition of fantasy, and Lewis really held up the old tradition at the same time. Now, these are two people doing completely opposite kind of approaches to fantasy, and we're still able to say that both of them can stand the test of time. Right, the film adaptions and stuff definitely brought people back to these texts.
Mm-hmm.
So they definitely were read, at least in my age group, in the mid-20s here. But I think that as a whole, usually people kind of stop there for a moment when we talk about classical fantasy. They say, oh, well, there's the Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the Rings, but...
What else is there?
Yeah,
something
else
I would probably suggest, at least to consider, are a couple of classics from the children's literature or YA canon. Stuff like Peter Pan, for instance,
oh,
or The Wizard of Oz, right?
Alice
and I might
Wonderland.
Even go to, Alice in Wonderland, by all means, and I might even throw The Little Prince in there. Things like that, for instance.
Absolutely, and that takes us away from an Anglophone tradition
sure.
to a more international kind of tradition.
Yeah.
Because I think stories like that, especially in the children's literature and YA genre, are quite prolific worldwide.
Yeah, yeah.
There's Peter S. Beagle's The Last Unicorn. I would definitely
sure,
say that's a classic.
Yep.
And it's beautiful, so do read it.
Now, I'm worried that when it comes to classics, maybe we're talking too far back in a way. Because fantasy has really had a lot of paradigm shifts in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
If we go back 20 years ago...
Harry
Potter is one of the biggest fantasy shifts, and so is Game of Thrones. These grim, dark stories alongside these all-ages wizarding school stories
and
are
so,
both kind of changing the genre dramatically.
And I think
in different directions.
Yeah. And I think they're culturally so omnipresent because it seems as though these days the world is divided between people, you know, those who actually did read Harry Potter and those who didn't. And those who did watch Game of Thrones or did read Game of Thrones and those who didn't, right? In both cases, I do admit to belonging into the latter category. And I'm not ashamed of it. But...
And now there's also the people who read Harry Potter and are now throwing out the author, death of the author.
Yeah.
And others who are just throwing it out completely.
Yeah.
And I mean, J.K. Rowling has been actually very influential in reminding us that we can abandon the author.
Mm. Oh, yes.
That's something a lot of fantasy writers, they kind of tend to have like a cultish following in a way.
Mm-hmm.
We think of right now, today, some of the most popular fantasy writers we have. Obviously, J.K. Rowling, we have George R.R. Martin, we have Jim Butcher, we have Brandon Sanderson, and there's tons of people following them on Twitter, talking to them. Patrick Rothfuss runs a blog where he talks about how he's not writing and he's doing charity work, and there's huge followings.
Do people hate that very much?
They do. And there are huge followings behind these people, and it's kind of nice in this genre to get some kind of pushback. And acknowledgement of some theory, actually.
I mean, with the case of Harry Potter, it's completely moving away now from the author because of the controversial statements that she has recently made public on Twitter.
Yeah.
And the fandom, because that's a term that we should be using with when we talk about fantasy and sci-fi as well. The fandom has taken this world, the wizarding world of Harry Potter, for itself. And really separated it from the author.
Yeah.
And there's so much more now within the Harry Potter fandom than there was 20 years ago. There's fan fiction, there's fan art. There's all these different things that the fans have made for themselves that have influenced the series. As Harry Potter is so much more now than just the seven books.
And maybe this 100%. Is something unique about speculative fiction in the sense that it is able to generate that it is able to energize those sorts of responses. And I'm not suggesting that other fields or genres or areas don't have that same energy or capacity. It just strikes me as kind of interesting that that it has this certain energizing effect.
I would say that there's much more fan engagement with speculative fiction texts. There's many more people engaging with fantasy by writing their own stuff. And I personally think that fan fiction is absolutely a valid form of literary production.
Sure.
Yep. Intertextual to the core.
Absolutely.
Fantasy, yes, does seem to sort of, promote that, make that more likely to happen. But there's fan fiction about Shakespeare.
Yeah, sure, there is, by all means, yeah.
I think the very first fan fiction was about Jane Austen. Well, not the first fan fiction. The first fan fiction is probably some guy or woman millennia ago.
Writing about Robinson Crusoe or something.
Well, that wouldn't be millennia.
No.
Storytelling in the past.
Yeah, definitely.
That's basically fan fiction. Like, I've heard this story that the singer two villages over sang to
his
people.
Wow, that's interesting.
And now I'm doing what I want with it.
But that enables a completely new take on intertextuality, doesn't it? Because kind of suggests that the work of intertextuality is kind of... is fan fiction. Is the production of fan fiction at the end of the day. Interesting. I don't know.
I think it is kind of the...
Maybe, yeah.
I want to say Adornian idea. I might be wrong here, guys. This is off the cuff. That idea that intertextuality reaches a single story. They're always calling back to other texts, and it's really the text, the refrain that's happening.
Mm.
But I think we're really getting a little bit digression here.
Maybe we could end...
Which is okay. We're not going to end yet.
No. I was suggesting that probably we could... gravitate towards a conclusion of this podcast by addressing maybe limitations of speculative fiction, if that is at all interesting.
All right.
What were you suggesting?
I feel like we wouldn't really be doing justice if we don't cover the other genres.
Oh yeah.
We apologize for the length of this one, but maybe you'll get more out of it. You can also pause it and come back to it. This is a perfect time. This is like an intermission.
Yeah. Or just skip ahead.
I might put music here. All right, so we're back. and let's talk about limitations, because we were talking about fantasy, and there's certainly dozens of other fantasy authors who are really important right now, including George Lucas, who we could discuss in a very bunch of different ways, but we need to talk about magical realism, because I think that really puts to the test... well, magic and realism and speculative all in the same category. So,
interesting thing about magical realism, I guess, and I'm trying to hone in on that in the magical realism session, just foreshadowing that you will be seeing me there. The interesting thing about magical realism is that it suggests a binary where really none exists or doesn't have to exist, right? Which is something that I completely dislike about magic realism as it is being treated in not the entirety, but a certain part of the Western academic literary community. Being cautious here. The thing about magical realism is that oftentimes it is being used as a label, I would say, especially to make sense of a bunch of texts that don't really neatly fit into other categories. And I have a feeling that this happens very frequently with indigenous novels, right? Narratives written by indigenous authors from Australia, from North America, anywhere else in the world, right? It is the assumption that indigenous people would bring a certain kind of indigenous magic or indigenous spirituality to literary production, which is a kind of essentialism, I think, that has no place in 21st century literary criticism, I would say. And you see the category of magical realism apply to that type of literary production an awful lot as a marketing strategy, I would say, to cash in on a certain cultural essentialism that will make a novel sell, or just to put it in a box because it doesn't take other boxes, right? So you come up with the category magical realism. Oh yeah, it's got to be magical realism because it's written by Alexis Wright, who happens to be an Aboriginal Australian writer. And this is some of the discomfort that I'm experiencing with that because it seems to hone in on a binary where none really exists. But more about that in the actual session.
Yeah, I think that goes well into what I do in my research on fantasy literature, where there's this binary that doesn't necessarily need to be there.
Mm.
Lucas and I have sometimes a bit... jokingly, a little bit said that magic realism is really just a term for fantasy that is being read by academia, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, the part of that comes down to how magical realism is often defined. Usually they say something like, well, it's a story where they treat the one or two instances of magic as if they are real.
Hmm.
And fantasy kind of does that almost all the time.
Mind the binary.
It's very strange for a fantasy outside of a portal quest to act as if things are fantastic. It shows a complete disenfranchisement and disengagement from fantasy works. And so I think that's kind of where our criticism comes from there. Certainly there is something to say about Salman Rushdie's work or the Latin American work or Paddington, where we can say these are stories where there is one instance of magic. And that instance of magic is construed as real, and it emphasizes the real too.
And for that reason, precisely, magic realism, whatever you want to call it, has often been analyzed as an empowering strategy or as a strategy of empowerment. And I certainly get that. And that there are very plausible arguments out there. I just have this rather uncanny feeling that those are in the minority.
Yeah, me too.
I think maybe whether we define a text as magic realism or as fantasy also has to do with the percentages. Mm. As you just said there, in a magic realist text, we often have like one or two events in an otherwise completely ordinary world that is, you know, more magical, but still described in the same way as the rest of the story world. Whereas in fantasy, the focus is much more on the fantastical.
Mm.
But I still think that the boundaries aren't as clear, and that I think what we're all saying is it's always fluid and binaries are stupid.
Yeah, and magical realism really is that edge, I think. I think that's kind of, if there was a border that we could stake out between what is, I guess, fantasy, which we would consider right in the middle maybe, and the border on the real.
But I think it is also quite indicative of our, at least in this part of the Western literary tradition, our desire for compartmentalization, right? We need those boxes, we need those compartments, we need those clear-cut, definable sort of chunks of reality that we can map in a dialectical sort of way against others. So I think the existence of the very idea of magical realism as a field or a genre or a category is pretty much indicative of that of that obsession with boxes.
So let's throw out genres for a moment.
Ouch.
And switch to the Gothic mode.
Yeah.
So I think the Gothic mode starts with the Castle of Otranto. No one has ever read that before.
Except you.
Except me.
I have now.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations.
I still have
read it now. It's a crazy story. There's a giant skull.
It is absolutely... It's insane. It's like within the first five pages, a 15-year-old is crushed to death by the giant head of a statue. Just let that sink in.
Yeah, stuff like that happens. It's honestly not that exciting of a book if you read it today, because we've dealt with so much of these tropes. For people who don't know the Gothic mode, we're not going to define it. We have a whole video on that you can watch. But it would include stuff like detective fiction, noir, almost everything, maybe some people say, because there's all kinds of Gothic elements that have kind of dispersed into speculative fiction. So I think the popular examples are, I don't know, Frankenstein.
Yeah, Bram Stoker, Dracula.
Dorian Gray.
And today, certainly, we could just point and be like, oh, well, Stephen King's work.
The Shining, probably among the more popular ones and best known.
So horror is also something that we would associate with that, at least. Horror, ghost stories, and that those are very popular. We have we have books, but we also have TV shows, Netflix series, movies, that sort of thing.
There's like a bit of a distinction maybe between some more hyper-realistic detective fiction, but honestly there's so much detective fiction that is speculative out there. There's all kinds of paranormal detective stuff going on, and the detective is associated with this paranormal-esque figure to begin with.
I mean, Harry Potter can be read as detective fiction.
Right?
And isn't any detective fiction really speculative until the very moment resolution happens? Because that is where the speculation is then transformed into actual truth, probably. But
yeah, I mean, the whole process
of drawing conclusions and coming up with with answers to the question mm-hmm. whodunit, right?
I mean, it's a different kind of speculation, yeah, but sure. I absolutely agree.
I mean, structurally speaking. Yeah.
Mm. When it comes to the Gothic, I think it's also kind of like fantasy, where it's very clear-cut because we don't usually associate ghosts, demons, vampires. Ancient bloodlines, and bones, you know, causing our future demise to all be tied to the real in any sense, and certainly seems a bit speculative. And we've covered all these genres that we're going to talk about in the course for the most part. I'm sure there's some subgenres out there like science fantasy or whatever that steampunk. Could be covered, steampunk,
yeah.
Basically every punk out there. But I guess we should probably come to kind of a conclusion for a bit. So like the limits of speculative fiction is a good way to end, I think.
Mm. It's not really a conclusion that I have. It's more kind of a rough thought that I could inject here at this point. I am a bit worried about the ability, and please do offer your thoughts on this. I do worry a bit about the political applicability of speculative fiction, and this being a non-expert opinion or a non-expert question, really, is how capable are speculative fiction texts to really address some of the hands-on political issues that we are facing at the moment. Like, for example, climate change. We are in the midst of a pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mass extinctions and all these sorts of things. We are in the Anthropocene. Please go ahead and check out the bus video on the Anthropocene. Yeah.
Well, I'm a scholar of speculative fiction. The point of view I'm coming mm-hmm. from is that it's very effective in dealing with
cool.
those yeah. things and yeah. criticizing them, and fantasy and speculative fiction have always been used to criticize current events,
mm-hmm.
but in a way that sort of removes them from being criticized themselves,
because okay.
you can do it at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of say, oh, you know, I'm not really talking about our stupid king. I'm just talking about this king in Fantasyland A.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're still criticizing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of has a long tradition. I mean, if you think about
oh, definitely.
Macbeth, that's criticizing a certain royal line without really plunging into it and saying, I'm criticizing this particular
yeah.
king or whatever.
Like satire, like the work of the,
yeah.
of the court fool and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, mm. exactly.
When we think of our impending demise from all these different things, whether it be viruses or global warming, climate change, whether it's the, you know, the singularity is what a lot of people call this in the sci-fi community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the sci-fi community cares a lot about these cataclysmic events, and they take moments from the present and they use those so often as conditions to structure a science fiction mm-hmm. novel to not to predict the future,
mm-hmm.
but to show how the problems of today can be extrapolated into the future, and how just that extrapolation can show some very devastating futures. It can warn us. It can also model us futures where things might be a bit more optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing we do need in a time like this is some optimism as well. We need some hope.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the pandemic, and actually sales for speculative fiction novels that deal with pandemics have gone up.
Oh, wow.
This
yeah.
year, mm-hmm. there's this novel, Station 11, which, yeah. which deals with the pandemic, mm-hmm. and that has just skyrocketed to the Amazon charts. So clearly we are reading speculative fiction also to deal with the present.
Mm.
And it does provide criticism, but at the same time, it can also provide escapism. And I think I'm going to side with Tolkien here in saying that that's not a bad thing. Sometimes we need escapism. It's not a moral failing to just want to have some hours where you're just in Middle Earth rather than right here in the midst of a corona pandemic. And that's another function of fantasy that's different, separate from this criticism, but it's just as valuable.
I guess my conclusion on what speculative fiction's use is as a term is, I think first and foremost, marketing as a concept isn't a bad thing when it comes to literary fiction, because we're talking about organizing, creating a taxonomy so that readers can understand what we're talking about together.
Mm-hmm.
Speculative fiction has a much different weight to it and feeling to it than lit fic, a different weight to it than if we just say SFF. Mm-hmm. If I say I read SFF, you get a much different idea of what I'm reading than if I say I read speculative fiction. And there are certain classist maybe overtones to that, or intellectual overtones that we've talked about, same as with magical realism. But I think these can be useful because they give us at least a range of what we're talking about.
Yes.
And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, agreed.
Thanks for convincing me otherwise. I completely subscribe to many of the things that you guys just said, so thanks. Yeah.
Do you have any closing thoughts, Tina?
No, I think I'm quite happy with the closing thought of fantasy as this, or speculative fiction as this double escapist and also critical medium. So I think that's what I would like to leave our listeners with.
Yeah.
All right.
And by the way, I haven't been making a very genuine criticism here. Every field, forum, genre of writing has actually been questioned, you know, along those lines. As in, how capable is literary realism to make a political point? You know, how capable is science fiction really to address the struggles of, I don't know what...
I think scholars of speculative fiction are just particularly protective of their genre because it's still not taken seriously everywhere. It's like there's still literary scholars who won't take it seriously. So
I'm actively declaring myself guilty of a platitude right here. But I did this on purpose because it sparked an absolutely valuable discussion and talking point.
And I think this has been a podcast you could listen to on a train ride or two or three.
Yeah.
And I hope that it has been useful to you all. So thank you all for coming to the podcast, but also thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for following along. See ya.